can't take these twists and turns, man, I don't blame you. I said, listen, I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man.
All right, hi, welcome to Live Monster MTA. I'm really excited to be here. We're just a minute or two late, but got a great panel of folks coming on tonight, and I'll let them introduce themselves in a moment. I'm Jordy Comis. I'm one of the co-producers one of your guest hosts tonight for this episode. You know, it's a little trite. We are doing Labor Day, but I think we've got a great group of people to talk about it. Yeah, I wasn't sure. Dave Camper, who you're going to hear from in a second, is a labor historian. I wasn't sure if this is the day you're in highest demand. you get the least time off, Dave, on Labor Day?
I'm rarely in demand at all, especially okay. For anything video. I clearly have a face for radio.
Well, you know, this was Second Life as a podcast. So we're going to talk some about sort of generally the state of labor today. I'm particularly interested in, you know, what it, you know, being open and honest and positive, but also, you know, critical where we need to be. But like what needs to happen? I think most of us are familiar with the overall picture, which is unionization rates seem, you know, they're low and they keep going. They might have ticked up a little bit in the last couple of years, but overall are historic lows, especially the Amazon Bessemer at Bessemer, Alabama, which got a lot of publicity in April. So I'm going to, I already mentioned Dave, but I'm going to, Dave, ask you to say hi, you know, where you're coming from and your interest in labor and anything you want to plug.
Yeah. Hey, folks, I'm Dave Camper. It's Camper with a K, happy Camper with a K. I'm in Minnesota, so I'm an hour behind you all. These days, after 20 years as an organizer, these days I work for the Economic Policy Institute, which is sort of the labor movement's think tank. But I want to stress right up top front of the show, speaking for myself, not for the organization, just in case I get off, you know, and say things that I would rather not. I'm in addition to 20 years as an organizer, I do have a PhD in history I very occasionally use. One of the things I'm affiliated with, which maybe later on in the show, if we have some time, we could talk about, is something called the New Brookwood Labor College. Some of you who know the history of American labor know that in the 20s and 30s, people like the Ruther brothers and Ella Baker, the civil rights leader, went to this place in upstate New York called the Brookwood Labor College, which was this sort of hippie commune labor college thing. And it really trained a whole generation of labor leaders who, like when the big stuff started happening in 1934, 35, 36, suddenly these people were trained and ready to go. And so we in the Twin Cities are kind of trying to do that sort of, you know, new steps, you know, revisit this thing again. And so I'll talk more about that later if you want to. We're pretty excited about it because COVID forced us to move online and it's been great.
Oh, that's interesting. Awesome. Okay. Yeah. I also like that because I've got I really like names that are not like the new Minnesota Labor College, right? Or like in Pennsylvania, like I have this joke that it's like the next thing we form is going to be the Keystone Pennsylvania Stand Up Together United We Act. Like we need a little bit more. So Brookwood, it's like it's a place. It's got a sort of place quality to it, right?
I feel like if you're going to do the most Pennsylvanian unique thing in a name, you got to call something prothonotary because nobody else has got a prothonotary.
I mean, have you been in Pennsylvania? That is some deep
I lived there for a year. I lived in State College for a year and a half. My first organizing job was at Penn State. Oh, failed miserably.
State, in State?
Oh, really?
Oh.
We got a butt kick. Wow.
That's a difficult area.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, since we've heard Hillary's voice, Hillary, why don't you say hi and what you're up to these days?
Hi, everybody. I'm Hillary Rothrock. I'm a home care worker. I take care of my disabled brother, who has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and I am a proud SEIU healthcare PA member. I'm also a member lobbyist and legislative liaison doing a lot of political work with the union.
Which union?
SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania, the Service International Union.
Right. And so tell me more about what did you say your role is with this campaign, political?
I'm a legislative liaison.
Okay. And what does that mean? Like, right. You know, you can pretend I'm as stupid as I'm sounding.
Basically, I'm a member leader and I help other members to meet with their elected officials. and make sure that they're developing relationships with each other and that we're educating our legislators on the work that we're doing and why we need what we need from our state legislature and other stakeholders.
And so is that Kearney Warren?
Kearney Warren was also a home care worker on the front lines, and she's currently running for city councilwoman in Chester, PA, which is just south of Philadelphia. And she's really desperately needed in that area. Their trash hasn't been picked up. They have an incinerator there for a lot of our nation's garbage, and it's affecting
the
quality.
Yeah, of course they do.
They don't even have a grocery store, you guys. They're a food desert. They don't have a grocery store in the city of Chester, and there's about 35,000 people that live there. So Kearney is running. She's on the ballot and looking forward to supporting her campaign.
That's awesome. So, you know, I don't have the number off the top of my head. Jeff, I don't know if you do, but I think like women have to be asked 7 or 8 times before they'll say yes to running or something like that, or 6 times. So were you one of those people, Hillary? Did you ask Kearney to run?
I did, in fact, ask her to run. She enrolled in the Emerge program. And so she will soon be a graduate of that program. And I told her this is her final, right, running for office. Because I believe all of the last class of Emerge, which is a program teaching women how to run for office and what to do and how to get there, I believe all of them won their races. So it's very
wow.
Exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, I've known a few folks who've been trained by them, and they've been really stellar. So awesome. Well, that kind of sets up because, Jeff, I feel, and tell me if I'm wrong, because we're still becoming better friends, but politics and sort of the political scene, that's really your home space, isn't it? Do you know Emerge?
I have heard of Emerge. I do know some candidates that I've worked with in the past who have graduated from Emerge. They all speak exceptionally highly of it. It is for women, so I have not been a part of it. I only
get
on their way out. Yeah, no, I'm glad everyone's sitting down, and I hate to shock you all. I am not a woman. I'm glad everybody's okay with that. But this is a very unique position for me. I feel an odd sense of calm and relaxation being the least intelligent person in the room. I'll be the dummy over here in the corner making faces. Sounds good to me.
Not above making faces across the table.
Well, tell us about your show and why you started it and maybe some of the work you do. You work as a political consultant, is that right?
I have many, many hats. I have a 40-hour, 50-hour a week plus job during the day. I also am one of 5 partners in the Blue Collective comprehensive political consultancy. We are a holistic, I should probably say nonprofit because there hasn't been one, political consultancy. I'm also chief strategist for Our Revolution Pennsylvania. And I am the host and presenter of my own humble program, The Kennedy Effect, which airs live normally every Sunday. We took yesterday off for Labor Day weekend. Every Sunday from 5 p.m. We began it because I talk way too much. And I've been doing radio and TV since I was in high school. And there is a shocking lack of progressive media in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And it's really interesting to have Dave here because I think one of the great things about our program, but yet one of the things that I've actually had people tell me is a bit boring about our program, which is something you never want to talk about when you're talking about entertainment, is that I don't stand on top of the desk. I don't name call. We don't ask gotcha questions. We don't name call. We don't swear. We go by FCC rules. We talk a lot about history. And I think one of the great lost things about progressivism and progressive policies, and as we're going to talk today about labor policies, is that we've done these things before. You know, the New Deal worked. Labor built this nation. It built the middle class. Labor's building the middle class in other countries. We're watching the policies that built the United States build other parts of the world, including the India-Pakistan region, the Near East, Polynesian areas, and yes, China. We talk about, you know, the right likes to talk about, we don't want to be more like Europe. How did Europe get like Europe after World War II? We gave it to them. We helped them rebuild and write constitutions laced with New Deal policies because we believed in them. And the labor movement is not, I am not a union member. I've never been a union member. I wish I was currently, and I wish I had been in my past life. I might actually be able to do wild and crazy things that are labeled as radical, like afford my doctor. I've only just regained health insurance in the last couple of weeks. I went from January till the end of July or mid-August without any health coverage. We're the only country on earth that has for-profit health. We're the only country on earth that so desperately, well, we're not the only country, that's a stretch, but we're one of the very few, and we're certainly the only OECD country that devalues labor as much as it does. And I should and I should not overtalk everybody. I took a long time there. I apologize.
No. That's okay. My job, don't worry. I'm here to reel you in. I mean, Jeff, one thing, like, I'm also full disclosure, I've never been a member of a union. It's worse. Like, neither of my parents were union members. I you know, if you don't know me already, I come from a very bougie background. With my parents were professional. And so I want to, you know, I try and understand the history, but, you know, I definitely feel that I need to be doing some listening here. You know, I'm really appreciative that we have Hillary and Dave. And to go back to, you know, what you were saying, Jeff, like, you know, I guess we rely on verve and wit and charm to attract people instead of like screaming and shouting. I mean, I, you know, like, there's other places in there's the angry left if people want to go and hear that. I mean, I tried to get a couple of my high school buddies to come on tonight. I was like, snark and critique is welcome, but not trolling. but I actually maybe just kind of want to throw out, I mean, I'm going to put, if people are out there, Hillary put some actions going on with SEIU, maybe just throw out, because it kind of leads up to something that, hopefully this will work. I'm going to play something from Aaron earlier, Aaron Tracy, but, I'm just curious, like, off the top of your head, you know, when was the first time you, let's say, kind of like heard about a union or sort of understood what it was? Like, I'll go first. For sure, it was high school AP US history, and it was the 1870s and 80s and the labor strikes. I think Haymarket Square, maybe, or a place in Chicago, and something like that. And it just wasn't part of my, I mean, I also grew up in a right to work state in Tennessee, in the South, in East Tennessee, pretty low union density, I'm pretty sure. So, I think that, you know, we can't shake where we came from, but just curious, do other people want to throw out, like, when did you first, you know, not hear union, but understand what it was?
For me, I was 15 years old and I got a job bagging groceries at the local grocery store. I lived in the suburbs of Chicago, and, it was a UFCW shop, and it was the first time I'd ever been in a union or was aware of it. I was a probationary employee for the first 90 days. And under that contract, you were not covered by the contract during a probationary period. Nonetheless, after those 90 days, they charged back dues for that 90-day period, which I now know is like terribly illegal. I never met a union rep. I never was invited to a meeting. I never saw a copy of my contract. I knew nothing about it. Every 3-4 months, I get a newsletter telling me who to boycott. The thing I never thought about.
What other, who would you be boycotting?
Companies that were non-union grocery stores.
They would be selling, gotcha. Not like Nabisco, but other grocery stores.
Other grocery stores. I don't even know if we had Walmarts in suburban Chicago in 1990, but if we did, then Walmart would have been on the list too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in places like Sears Roebuck, which of course, historically the terrible union busting retailer in the 50s and 60s. And like all the contradictions of the 80s and 90s labor movements were there, because the full-time cashiers, this is 1990, the full-time cashiers were making $20-$21 an hour. They got full health insurance. They had a pension.
In 1990.
Vacation. In 1990, they had a full, you know, pension, benefit, vacation, health insurance, the whole business. Like you could make a living checking groceries for 40 hours a week. But for the 15 and 16 year olds who worked there, who were just a transient workforce, no one ever really put the work into us. And so if that had been my only experience with unions, I'd have never been interested in the movement after that.
Holy shit. $20, that's $42 in today's dollars for a cashier. Like, that's also because I feel like usually grocery stores, grocers, and generally the food industry is like, our margins are so thin, our margins are so thin. Wah, 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 wah. So this was a company that obviously, you know, didn't go bankrupt the first week you worked there.
Yeah, no, no, it was, you know, but how, I mean, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. I'm not entirely sure how many of those people actually worked in the store versus how many were in my shoes. Whenever you have a two-tier workforce, the question is how many people are in which tier?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us were in that second tier where I made, you know, 50 cents more than minimum wage or whatever. You know, the one time I got written up, I didn't have a union rep with me, didn't know I could have had a union rep with me, didn't try to bring one in, you know.
Yeah. Okay. That's, well, that's great. So you worked at a union. Okay. Jeff, you know, your first, what, you know, moment you knew what a union was?
My brother, both brothers and my father were union members before they were moved into management. And at my very first job when I was 15 in a high school work program, after about a year or so, I tried to start a union.
Oh, really?
As a teenager. Yeah. Yeah. Because I didn't like how we were being, I just didn't think we were being treated properly. And I thought we could do better. And I knew we could do better if we all bargained together. And I don't know that it was so much me knowing that that was a union in and of itself as much as it was that I knew if we all stood together and that even this small, relatively small family company, it was actually a wholesale candy distributor. I knew that even though there was only about a dozen of us, if we all walked, that would mean something because they couldn't replace all of us at the same time. I failed. I absolutely failed. It never happened. But I did know that we were stronger together.
I think it goes to show you that kids understand this concept, right? Children understand. Mm-hmm. There's power in numbers.
There's a study that Tom Hartman quotes a lot that, you know, when 100 kids are put into a room with 100 cookies and you give 90 of those cookies to one or two of the children and the remaining 10 cookies are spread out amongst the remaining 98, the children inherently know that it's unfair. Mm-hmm. And they will then redistribute the cookies throughout the class. And we've lost that somewhere. It's been glorified. You know, greed is good, Gordon Gekko. And I'm sure both of you can probably speak very much to the fact that we've had a generation, actually several generations since Nixon, and especially since the imposition of Reaganism, that don't know any different. 725 sounds good to me. No union sounds good to me. Don't even know what it is. And we're fighting that generational, dare I even say, institutional knowledge.
And it trickles down into our communities that neighbors don't help each other anymore. We were just talking about that with our neighbors who their lawnmower died. And we're like, hey, you could borrow ours. And they were shocked that we would borrow our lawnmower to our neighbor so that he could cut his grass. The empathy has been lost on us. And I've been seeing that happen, like you said, for at least a decade and longer. Things have really changed.
So did we get to, apparently, you know, I'm the professional and my home internet cut out, but it sounds like you guys did fine. That's great. So Hillary, did you already talk about your first experience with the union?
No, Jeff.
Well, please go ahead.
So my older brother, who's 11 years older than me, he is a union carpenter. And so I heard a lot about his union at family dinners and gatherings. I myself tried to unionize, when I worked at crisis intervention, through mental health services or as caseworkers. We tried to unionize through AFSCME and were unsuccessful at that time because a lot of leadership at that time and place was against it. So the first chance I got to join the union was when a SEIU healthcare member came to my door while I was working with my brother and signed me up. And I've been very grateful ever since to have this union in this time and place, because they're very supportive, kind, compassionate people who are doing the right thing.
Right. So I just want to give a shout out. You know, one of the reasons we moved to doing a live format, although we will put this up on our podcast stream, is so we could build more interaction with the audience. We do have Heather Rhodes, who's a friend and an ally. So just a shout out to her. She's done great stuff in the Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area. I was so excited that I skipped over a little bit of housekeeping. So let me just mention, you know, if you're, this is your first time seeing or hearing the podcast, if you're, and you hear this all the time, but like, you know, like it, subscribe it, leave a review anywhere, that always helps. We're getting several hundred listens usually on the podcast stream, and the live part we're still building up. You know, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, anywhere. It's always Barnstorming PA. Sometimes if you see it without a space, it's just because that's what we have to do it. But officially, it is with PA. I don't really know the Rosh Hashanah greeting, like, you know, blessed Rosh Hashanah. It's Rosh Hashanah. So, yeah. So Taylor Lightman, who's my other co-host, is taking the evening off. But whatever the appropriate Rosh Hashanah blessings are for folks. And a shout out to Margot Vigiant, who's a recent patron of the show. If you go to our website, barnstormingpa.org, yeah, we are asking for money. This is, it started as a passion project. It's not free. Jeff can tell you it's not free to do this. I think at the end, I may pick your all's brains a little bit, because we do have some ideas for merchandise, and I want a little bit of feedback.
I will be donating my entire speaking fee. We're back.
Okay, great. The program. Yeah, excellent. Thank you. I think there's something about circulating zero value items in an economy. I'm not sure what that's,
ouch,
what that's called. Well, just because I didn't pay him. Well, this is a gift economy. Dave and I met through something called The Forge, which is an online journal and community forge organizing strategy and practice. I feel like it's such a treasure trove of stuff. I mean, there's so much good content there. If people go to that, I would love to even go back. It's been around for about 2 years now. And I mean, I'm still always, you know, catching up with what's there, and maybe bring some folks who've written things there into this space. Heather, I asked her the question too. She says she was an SEIU negotiator for healthcare in the facility. She says she's sorry she was a negotiator. I don't know why she's apologizing. Maybe she was a negotiator for the management side. Listen, Heather, we all, you know, we didn't make the system we have to live in. You shouldn't feel bad about that. Like, you know, this is a little bit one of these things. Like, I don't feel like it helps us as a left to spend a lot of time being virtue police, because, you know, the system is so big. You know, it's kind of like being mad at people for driving cars. Well, you know, what do you expect them to do?
Well, and it says something about, like, the nature of how labor works in this country now, that there was a time where being the management's negotiator was just considered a perfect, like that was a necessary part of what you had. Like, you have the union side, you have the management side. If you go back and you watch the great Canadian documentary from 1983-84 called Final Offer, you can get it on YouTube for free, called Final Offer. And it's all about the United Auto Workers negotiations in Canada. And it's a great documentary. It's all white guys in shirt sleeves smoking cigarettes in rooms and yelling at each other. But like the negotiator for management is portrayed as a perfectly reasonable person, as like a decent guy trying to do his job. He knows he's got to kind of see both sides, and he's got to represent his company, but he's not a jerk. He's not trying to be a problem. You know, like, he was doing his job, and that's just not something you see as much anymore, because the people who get hired for him now are different.
Yeah. On that note, I'm going to see if this works. I mentioned that Aaron Tracy, who's been a good friend to me personally, he's a labor organizer with his background, I think, is mostly SEIU. And he's now his title is political director for SEIU healthcare PA or SEIU PA, something. And I know he's a political director. He also, just fun little Aaron bit, So he spent a few years as a English teacher. So he was the high school English teacher when my eldest child, Laya, was in school, and so he also helped organize the students, and they had a kind of youth group that did some cool stuff downtown. But one of the funny things was they called it Active Millennials for Progress, but actually Aaron is more of Gen X, and they're all more Gen Z, so it actually had no millennials, but they just like the acronym AMP, which always kind of cracked me up.
So Aaron, it's great to have you on Barnstorming PA. We've known each other for several years. Could you just tell people briefly, you know, your background with labor organizing?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's good to be back. My name is Aaron Troisi. I'm lead political organizer with SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania, which is the largest healthcare union in the state. And I also help to run a separate nonprofit organization called Nurses of Pennsylvania that our union members sort of created as a way to engage not yet union caregivers in the fight for important policy changes in Pennsylvania. And I grew up in this area. I grew up around Millville, Bloomsburg, graduated from Hughesville. I now live in Lewisburg and have been helping to lead labor community political campaigns across Pennsylvania for over a decade now, over 10, almost 12 years now.
Awesome. So, I asked you to come on because yesterday you were kind enough to share some thoughts with our congregation, the Unitarian Universalist Susquehanna Valley. And I just thought it was really interesting. So I'm just going to ask two of you. One is, you talked about how sort of the broader American society and allies of, you know, in my words, like the goals of labor justice to talk about labor issues and organizing.
I definitely think so. And I think that's more true for people within the labor movement than beyond it, but certainly true for folks beyond it as well. I mean, I really think that, you know, when we think about Labor Day specifically, and American unions, like the sort of cultural go-tos that we all share are really old. They tend to be, early 20th century, right around the sort of moment that labor law was coming into existence in this country and unions were sort of creating the structures that we now know and have today, you know, or tied to other movements, right? So we hear about the sanitation workers and Dr. King, you know, who was obviously assassinated when he was on the picket line with striking sanitation workers. And so we hear these sort of labor stories that are not particularly modern. I mean, that's just like a reality of how we think and talk about the labor movement. And I think, you know, what we know is as we are now squarely in the 21st century, but you know, having been part of the movement for the last 10 years, a lot of talk through the movement has been happening around what does it look like to have a 21st century labor movement, particularly because the nature of work is changing so dramatically, right? And so I think we do need to think about labor in a much more modern context. And we need to think about what that means. In my mind is thinking about how we organize workers in potentially new, creative, innovative ways that actually break down the traditional silos in our sort of industries and really think.
Okay, I'm going to pause there and make Aaron go away for a moment. Let's see. Has that got everybody back now? Oh, now Hillary is like larger. There we go. Okay. So Hillary and Dave, can you guys, because you're the closest to labor, you know, what do you think about what Aaron is saying there about, you know, it's this, we're sort of in a moment where we need more innovation and the labor, you know, we've maybe been locked in the past. You know, does that resonate or, you know, do you think you do put it differently?
Hillary, you go.
Okay. All right. I mean, it definitely resonates. The workplace has changed so drastically since the early 1900s. You know, now everybody's working from home if they can, and if they can't, they're getting together in their break rooms and talking to each other about how work can be a better place for everybody and how we can have this work-life balance, right? We all want to enjoy our lives in addition to working. I work two jobs, so I work pretty much 24/7. But I get to spend a lot of time with my family doing that. And that's one of the really great things about organizing at this point is as a single mom, I can take my kids with me to work and it's encouraged, you know, not just accepted, but encouraged to do so. And there's not a lot of positions that moms and parents, single parents, can find that allows for that kind of freedom and that kind of connection with the next generation. So Aaron, he's a little younger than me. So he kind of is in touch with that younger generation. My kids are teenagers and they're pretty fierce social justice warriors and enjoy taking action with me. But I think because things have changed so drastically, we just need to completely look outside the box of how we've done things before and do some innovating work around organizing people and listening to the people who are in the workplaces at this time and what they want and how they want to do it.
I mean, I think what Heather says there, the essence of that's exactly the right answer. You've got to be guided by whatever the workers want, right? You've got to be, you cannot walk into a work site with a one size fits all model of how unions work and say, this is how it goes. And indeed, you know, if we get to a place where we talk about Jane McAlevey, it's one of my criticisms.
We will any minute, any second now.
where I feel like she's got a bit of a one size fits all model, where everybody has to take the Cadillac and there's no room for anybody to get the 20-year-old Datsun. But that being said, what's the line of Marx? People make their own history, but they make it, but they make them under time, places, and circumstances not of their own choosing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of basic barriers around how we operate that says to me that the way we build is going to look a lot like the way we've always built. It's going to have more digital elements. It's going to have to deal with more people not physically working and living near each other as often as it did back in the day. Those things have to be adjusted, but you're still going to have a lot that's going to be the same.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just sort of listening to y'all, it sort of reminds me of these couple of points, and I hope this doesn't seem too simplistic, but like one is, Hillary, you were talking about like the appeal to you of being a home healthcare worker and being able to have your kids involved. You know, I think sometimes some of the big social changes that happen kind of slowly, or they're so important, but they're kind of so obvious. We don't talk about them enough. But one of them is women entering the workforce. I mean, when you look at the 20th century of America and the number of women who are in paid work out of the home, that is one of the massive changes. And in some ways, I'm not enough of a labor economist or economic historian. I don't know if you are, Dave, but you know, I think there's an argument to be made that some of the stagnation in wages in the United States during the 60s, 70s exactly coincides when you have so many more women entering the workspace. The other is, so that's one big trend. The other is, yeah, like work has changed. And so, you know, like part of my background is studying organizations, including business organizations, but like, you know, if a lot of people think a labor organization or a union is going into like a big centralized like GM style or Standard Oil or these massive kinds of organizations, that's not how the work is done. You know, it's done in terms of gig things. I've talked to Hillary a little bit about this before, but the ways in which your work is, you know, you work technically for the person who's getting funds, I think from the state or somewhere, right, for their own home healthcare needs, and they're employing you. So like the employer-employee relationship has been outsourced, right? That's how I think about it, if that sounds right. Like, I don't want to describe your experience the wrong way, but you know, there's not, who's your man, who's the manager that you would, right? It's your own patient. So those kinds of like what work is, and my own experience with unions mostly right now, honestly, is as a local official, and I deal with the police union and the AFSCME for our staff. And so, you know, like Jane McAlevey's, you know, I've heard her talk, Dave, and one of her things is the first question I go in is, and I say, what do you want as a worker? And depending on the police, what they want may not be what I want as a progressive. And I realize that there's like police unions considered different, but you know, this idea that all unions are the same, I just kind of want to throw out, there's a lot of sort of moving parts there, but does anybody want to react? Jeff, you were talking a little bit about, I don't know, I missed that in the chat, right to vacation.
Well, when Hillary mentioned that we want this work-life balance, it immediately reminded me of President Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights. I don't need to tell you all, but the audience may not be aware, we've had the original Bill of Rights is a political statement. It's political rights, it's political liberties, free speech, press, et cetera, et cetera. FDR wanted an economic bill of rights, economic justices and freedoms, and so the right to a job, the right to a home, the right to see, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, the right to see a doctor. And actually part of that was the right to recreation was the term he used, but that meant a vacation, that an American family should be able to afford to go on a vacation. And it was a, it's an idea that needs to be revisited. I think it's an idea that labor tends to hold in its own heart. I think when labor negotiates for these types of, when they negotiate a contract with a company, I think it's the economic bill of rights that's in their brain, even if they don't know it, even if they're not thinking of it consciously. I think that's what it is. We want to see a doctor. We want time off. We want to be paid fairly for our work. It's the economic bill of rights. And if we are as great a country as we think we are, it should be very simple to pass all of them and implement all of them.
Well, sure. And this is something I like wordplay a lot, but, you know, fairly recently in life, I realized that recreation, which often gets kind of tossed away, it's leisure, it's frivolous, right? It's not, is literally recreate, you know, that you need the time away. And if you look at the most, you know, I know a lot of academics, I was an academic, there was a built-in sabbatical, you know, imagine if that, I mean, this is really out there, but you know, if we encourage people to take that time to develop themselves as full humans.
And economic activity, Jordy. Mm-hmm. Economic activity. Look at, Kristen and I live 5 minutes south of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Right.
The Bethlehem Steel Plant is a tourist attraction.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that, especially as a casino. You know, I used to live in Bethlehem also.
But the idea of recreation is exactly what you said, in my humble opinion. It is recreate. That's the root word.
Oh, right.
But it's also economic activity. How much money gets poured into the state of New Jersey during the summers with the economic activity at the Jersey Shore? Here in our own Commonwealth, visiting Philadelphia, visiting Pittsburgh, visiting the Poconos.
Look,
visiting
around here, most of the small towns in rural PA, part of their resilience strategy is to be the key place, and I'm in the middle of that. Lewisburg, it's you know, people like it's so adorable. Look, exactly. I want to push us to the Jane McAlevey. So I made my like very patient and kind guests read this article from The Nation. So to set this up, you know, in Amazon, I think in April was an attempt to organize in Alabama. I think it's pronounced Bessemer, Alabama, an Amazon, I'm pretty sure it's like a warehouse. You all fill in any of the details, distributing facility. And it's been on my mind for two reasons. One, because Amazon is obviously such a visible like company. It's massive in terms of revenue. I don't know the number of employees, but for sure, you know, Facebook has a huge market capitalization and very few employees, like a lot of tech companies. Amazon is a company of stuff and things. So there are, you know, a lot of people work there. And I think the general narrative, but maybe we want to push back. But the general narrative was it got a lot of attention broadly from the left. President Biden made a statement that was very pro-union. It seemed like this was the time. I think a lot of people on the left generally saw it as like Biden won, we stopped the insurrection, and now we're finally going to get back on track the way we were supposed to be. Maybe this was what you were saying, Jeff, and finally get a win against an Amazon. And we mentioned Walmart earlier, which is infamous for never being able to be organized, and I think has a million employees. It's one of the largest employers in the United States. And it failed. The organizing drive failed. And Jane McAlevey's got three big reasons. I'll just leave my teacher hat on for just a sec. You know, she tends to, she says there's sort of the big picture. It's really hard to organize the United States, and this deck is stacked against labor organizing. We all know that. The second chunk is has to do with mistakes made at the tactical level by the union that was organizing. And I'm actually blanking a little bit on like the third. Like she laid it out in threes, but I think in my mind the tactics and how they adapted were sort of related. But basically, sort of saying Bessemer and Alabama are different than other places, and the tactics weren't well adapted. So basically, I think the big three were, but you all correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, union busting is easy and legal in the United States. Is the first. The second is tactical errors that were made that had to do with, for example, relying on digital media or relying on meeting workers at the plant door as opposed to home visits. And the third was not the best context for Alabama. So I hope I've set it up. Who wants to go first? Dave, I think you're chomping at the bit.
No. Let everyone else go because I'll just talk all that the whole time.
Okay. Well, Hillary, you're in a union that is organized. You know, what did you get out of reading the her analysis?
I mean, I feel like her analysis was pretty in-depth and thorough if you're coming at it from a business standpoint, right? If I come at organizing very differently, my background's in mental health and specifically in crisis work and working with families. And when I think of organizing work, oh, there's the article. When I think of organizing,
I'm gonna see if I can make it less obnoxiously big though.
When I think of organizing, I think of just like I do every other relationship with that happens between people. Every relationship between two people is unique and different because every person is unique and different. And so when you're talking about organizing a group of people, right, first of all, the people have to want to be organized. They have to want it, and they have to want it really badly.
Well, and that's one of the errors she points out is that the organizers, like at a very narrow level, she was saying, like, for example, they asked, do you want to have an election as opposed to do you think we should have a union?
Exactly. And so that would be a mistake by the organizers, right? That's not something that naturally was occurring. That's a mistake they made in their campaign, which she went into detail on. But when it really comes down to it and you have relationships and you have people who are in positions of power and they don't mind using that power to prevent workers from organizing. And if you have relationships between people who just don't want it badly enough and are willing to do what it takes. For example, a hunger strike, right? For example, taking to the streets or striking like they did. So even though you might have a small group of people that are into that, if you are not capable of building out those relationships, if you're not capable of meeting one-on-one with people and listening to them and what they want and what they need, and you move too fast and too hard, people get left behind and people don't get listened to and the movement doesn't happen. So, you know, it's one of those things that we did seize the moment because the moment is now for change, right? That's what's happening. It just happened, I think, in my personal opinion, it happened too fast. It happened, you know, there's unhealthy relationships in all kinds of manners. And sometimes when you go too fast into something, it's just not built correctly.
And right. So you're imagining that the people running the campaign were going too fast?
Yes.
I mean, you know, just this last weekend, actually, Jeff, it was what Nina had, and I thought it was really great. So we were on a call that Nina Ahmad, you know, was leading, and there was something that went by a little fast, was basically kind of saying from public polling, like a majority of Americans support the right to organize or things like that. And it was kind of left there. And I don't mean, I mean this more as a critique of like our strategies, but I feel like I've seen this before, you know, people saying like Americans support this, that, or the other thing, you know, whether it's healthcare or whatever. And then there's just kind of like broadly on the left, there's like, and so therefore we're going to get it. What I say, or like with politics, demographics is not strategy, or polling majorities are not strategy.
Yeah. I mean that one of the best reads on this is Pennsylvania's own. See, look, I'm bringing in the local angle here.
You're better at this than me. I'm obsolescing myself.
Paul Clark, who's a professor of labor relations at Penn State, and he wrote a really thin book, not that part, to recall, Building More Effective Unions. And he says, look, there's three elements here to getting people engaged in union. One is they've got to agree with what the union's up to. Two, someone's got to ask them. But the third piece is that they've got to see a connection between their own involvement and success in the action. And this is the part that I think we struggle with when we say, well, everyone, like 77% of people under 30 support unions, according to the latest poll. Like, oh my God, we should be. But people, it's not just enough to support it. You've got to be willing to invest time, mental energy, spiritual energy, physical energy into this project when you could be doing other things with your life. And you're only going to do that if you've got a decent enough chance of success. And one of the strengths of an anti-union campaign like Amazon's you know, they had banners in the work site. They had buttons that all the managers wore. They brought people in for captive audience meetings after captive audience meetings. It was not about persuading these workers that the union is a bad idea. It was about sending the message to the workers that if you do this thing, we're going to make your life miserable forever, so don't bother. And that is a really heavy thing to overcome. That is an incredibly difficult thing to overcome. And you can't do it without starting from a lot stronger of a place than it seems like that campaign started in Bessemer, where, you know, the gold standard, and I think there's lots of reasons to doubt the gold standard in terms of its utility for the world. But the gold standard is you have 75% of those people to have signed a union card saying, I want a union, before you even call for an election. Like, you should have such a huge supermajority that you can afford to lose a ton of your people and still win. The problem with that gold standard view, and that's what McAlevey really lays out, is that if you follow only that gold standard, you're going to get about 10 elections a year where about like 500 people are going to join a union every year and will dwindle into nothing in a generation, because you have to do more than that in order to get there. And how you do that is a rough one.
I mean, go ahead, Hillary.
Just in response to what Dave just said, that's why a lot of this movement is being led by women of color, because they wake up every day and have to fight against things like that. Being a single mom, I get it. I'm only 40, but back when I first started out, I was pregnant and I was told I wouldn't be hired if they had known I was pregnant at the time. So, you know, still to this day, that's the stuff that's happening in our employment. And so basically what has to happen is the people have to want it and not be intimidated. And a big part of that is empowerment and leadership development. That's something that SEIU Healthcare does very well. And I think that's why we become so successful here in Pennsylvania with our political team. Because it takes time. It takes time to develop those relationships and the trust between people when you're doing work like this. And I think that if you don't give it enough time, you may be, I'm not saying doomed to failure, because I don't think that that's the case at all. I think you'd have to have a really special group of people who are just very trusting in each other and have gone through something like a lot of frontline workers have over the last 18 months. That has built that trust in a faster manner than typically would be.
I mean, Jeff, you found, you want to just throw out some sort of appointed yourself our running researcher, you know, on the fly researcher.
I was quickly trying to Google that while you called on me. I feel like the kid that got caught in class with guns.
Oh, well, you put it in the chat, so I thought you knew it was true.
But it is my understanding, and from past reporting, that Amazon spent over $6 million in fighting the Bessemer unionization effort. And a large chunk of that was spent after the cards had been signed to schedule that election. I think we should keep in mind that the article itself, for as much, and I had a tough time with the article. I have a tough time reading. I bounce all over the page. I'm sure if I was born in a later date, I would have been diagnosed with something. But I do have a tough time reading. But what I took from it was even though the steps that Amazon took to stop this effort were laid out in the article, it's still undersold. Properly undersold. This election, by the way, there is an excellent chance that there's going to be a second election, and the Department of Labor is investigating what happened in Bessemer, and especially the intimidation and scare tactics and threats and you name it. And I could probably make a longer list and you know, say the same thing 20 times of what was done to the organizers and the ground level, which is a bad term, but the ground level employees at this fulfillment center. And make no mistake, if this one fulfillment center had gone, I think you would have seen a ripple effect across the country at every Amazon fulfillment center. And by the way, we have three of them right here in the Lehigh Valley.
Yeah, but that's
what they were afraid of.
Yeah,
and I think And if
Time out, just real quick, because I don't know, I want to raise the energy level. But like, why would the National Retail Workers, whatever, why pick Bessemer as your test case? Like, that's Alabama, for God's sake. Like, they should have tried to do it in Michigan or California.
So here's what almost certainly happened. And bear in mind, I know nothing. And one of the big challenges here is that none of us actually know what happened. And that's a real challenge. And frankly, it's too bad there's not a way for us to know better. But what almost certainly happened is that this is what's called in the labor world a hot shop scenario, where you had a group of workers. It could have been as few as one or two really excited people who went to the local union and said, we can do this here. We really believe in this. And and somebody kind of got carried away with the excitement of it all, right? Somebody got carried with, all right, let's go for it. And they went ahead and ran with it. And that's what hot shop organizing is. And that's a lot of the organizing in the country today, is that somebody just like, I feel like there's some energy, let's go. And the thing about the hot shop strategy is that there are times when it works, when you just catch that wave and you ride that son of a gun all the way, I'm sorry, we can swear, ride that son of a bitch all the way down the line to get it done. If you look at the 1930s and the upsurge of labor, you know, with the CIO, like that was all hot shops. It was just people showing up and organizing and going and fighting. And all of a sudden they started winning. And the fact that some of them started winning meant more started winning. All of a sudden everybody was winning, though, except many didn't and many were killed. And it was not all victories. But, you know, that it's all well and good to be like you should have had a perfect strategy and you didn't have 75%. Yeah. It's another thing to have that really motivated worker standing in front of you saying, I can deliver this because I know the workers here and we need a union and I can make it happen. Believe me. And, you know, I can criticize till the day, like all damn day, but I can sympathize with that organizer. It's like, okay, we're going to carry this out with you. We're going to go all the way because damn it, you're here and you believe it.
I can paint another story, and I have no way of knowing if this is true, but like just sort of generally, and this is a thing for me, is like people, I think, sometimes forget that there are people who have careers and ambitions inside these organizations making decisions. And so the hot shop thing also seems to me to play out within a union. Somebody's like, man, like we have been getting the shit kicked out of us for a long time. If we won this, think how great that would be, you know, and then, you know, they want to, they get invested in it because there's layers of decision makers. But the hot shop strategy, it's funny because today I was trying to find something from Russell Luxemburg that's been bugging me for like 2 years I can't find. But it's basically like, you know, movements throw up energy. If you don't know Russell Luxemburg, she was a 19th century, I don't know a lot about her, but just total firebrand. And she kept telling Marx and all the other sort of boys, like, pipe down, you know, let the women be in charge. But like one of her things was like, there's this energy that sort of comes from, like, I would say in my language, like from networks of people getting more interacting more and getting cohesion and that energy feeding off of each other. And that kind of sounds a little bit, Dave, you know, like kind of like that happens at the hot shop. And I do this all the time, you know, like if anything, I critique myself because we just pushed a meeting back for the Hub for Progress a week because of the National Women's March on October 2nd. And in the back of my mind is, are there people honestly from George Floyd or from racial justice or from, you know, climate change who are like, well, why is everybody paying attention to that? I mean, not that that doesn't matter, right? But there is this feeling, I think, of like the sort of like excess energy of like the left kind of goes to the bright, shiny object. And if you don't capture it, you're not going to make the big wins. I don't know if that made any sense. Mm-hmm. Did any of it? like one of the things about Bessemer was it caught, right? Didn't it catch the attention of the national, like, you know, lefty media and all that?
Which can be very difficult to do, right? We shout into the void daily and mm-hmm. sometimes we get a bite.
Well, I want
to... And there's an argument to be made and not one that I think I would make. But an argument could be made that even by losing, by drawing so much attention to the evil anti-labor practices, just as the PRO Act is floating around, it kind of like the Protecting the Right to Organize Act is not going to pass in all its glory. But there's a pretty good chance that we're going to get some significant chunks of it in reconciliation, much to majigger, if it ever happens. Like some real things might come out of it, and that Amazon campaign was perfectly timed. This is perfect. To give people some energy.
Could you describe one? Because I don't know what's in the PRO Act. Is there one that comes to mind that if it had been in place?
Mm-hmm. Here's a real simple one. So if you fire somebody from a workplace because they're a woman or because they're disabled or because they're a person of color, you can not only like be sued to get that person their job back, but you can get punitive damages and all kinds of other stuff. And even under certain very strong, like just potentially even felonies and so forth. If you fire someone for joining a union, for being involved in a union right now, and you just, it's straight up, you did it. And they absolutely prove that you did it. And it's against the law to fire someone for trying to join a union. All that happens is you get back wages for the worker, and the employer has to stick up a little piece of paper in the work site saying we did wrong. And if the worker got a job in the meantime to make some money, then all you have to give them is the difference between what they would have made while they were working with you and what they made in the other job. And so it is frankly economically very rational right now for an employer to fire people who are organizing. Like, it's terrible. It's morally and ethically bankrupt, but it's economically absolutely sensible. One of the things the PRO Act might do is put in fines of up to $50,000 per violation. That changes the calculus completely, because you've got 5,800 workers in that Amazon fulfillment center. You could theoretically file a charge on behalf of all 5,800 people. That's 5,800 charges, $50,000 times $5,800. Like, that's going to add up even for an Amazon. And for smaller, medium-sized employers who cannot afford a $50,000 hit, or several of them, like, that's going to fundamentally change it. And that's because it's a revenue raiser. It's one of these things that might fit the budget stuff with reconciliation, because they're looking to raise revenue. If you can add a punitive element to this, where you break the labor law, you don't just pay back wages, but you got to pay 50 grand, not to the person, but to the government, but still, who cares? Pay it to somebody. That changes the math a lot.
Right. I mean, you know, like I want to kind of go for the fences here. You know, we're maybe kind of running out of time, but a little bit, and if this is a jerk question, please smack me around. But like, as somebody who's, you know, pretty much a lifelong progressive, I'm a little bit like, you know, I know that like NAFTA was horrible, right? And really gutted the ability of unions, especially industrial unions. In fact, my own thing is like, you know, I'm still mad at Bill Clinton, because to me, there should have been a global minimum wage that was tied to cost of living differences in countries so we could stop a race to the bottom. You know, why was that a side agreement? But that's a whole nother podcast. But anyway, like, I'm just kind of like, I'm just going to say this. I'm like, why did the, because it is true that the unions are some of the biggest pots of money and smarts and energy on the left still. How did we get to this point where we have such low unionization? Why was Walmart not the number one target since 1990 or 1985? It has 1.6 million employees, or somebody else, or I don't know. Like, you know, how did it get to this point? Is it the Democratic Party's fault? Because I think some lefties want to blame the Democratic Party.
No, labor's got to own most of this itself.
That must make you popular.
I mean, first of all, like, let's be really clear, like the playing ground is tilted so heavily against it. But one of the things that happened is that the playing ground moved before people realized it did. Mm-hmm. And because one of the things we forget now where we sit is that from 1940 to 1980, the American labor movement and the power of unions fundamentally built a middle class across the country. There's a reason people believe in, like, they want to go back to steel jobs now. If you've gone to someone in 1930 and say, would you like to work in a steel mill? Like, hell no.
Yes.
It was deadly. You died. Yeah. You got paid nothing. You were injured all the time. Like, it was a horrible job. By 1960, working in a steel mill was steady employment. You got vacations with pay. You got your health insurance. You got your pension. You got a cost of living every year. And that lasted for 40 years. And it started getting bad. But because for individual people and individual unions, they weren't experiencing that themselves. You know, if you live in a place that hasn't experienced deindustrialization, that your plant hasn't closed, you're still sitting pretty. It took too long for labor to realize things had changed. And by the time labor kind of got around and realized, oh, crap, the ground has shifted out from under us, and now we got to move. The legal regime had switched so badly that it wasn't easy to claw back. And so the lost decade is kind of the 80s, where the writing was on the wall and they didn't react in a way that they could have. Now, it's possible they could have done everything they could and nothing would have happened. But you can't tell the story without remembering that things were so good for so long that lots of perfectly reasonable people assumed that's how it was always going to be.
And they still
do. And we can say to those people, you are wrong. But the truth is, if you're sitting in 1979 and you're a union leader and union membership numbers have gone up every year since 1935, you know, union density started dropping in the 50s, but the actual numbers of union members went up until 1979. And you're saying, we're, every year there's more of us. Every year there's more of us. Every year we're winning more things for people. This seems all right to me. And things were shifting, bad things were happening. You should have noticed, but I can understand why they didn't.
But were they, I mean, but by 1983, 84, 85, 86, like why, you know, it seems like the stagnation has persisted until now.
Well, I don't accept that. I think you see a lot of things. I think there's been a ton of really exciting, like the, so you look at SEIU and the Justice for Janitors campaigns they started running in the 90s, like brilliant organizing campaigns that brought in tons of people and had really innovative models of doing things. And the explosion of healthcare organizing over the last three decades, and what we're seeing now,
which in a way, just let me point out, it is actually the organizers following the workforce, because the workforce is, there are not that many industrial workers compared to, you know, service workers. You know, the healthcare economy has been growing so much faster. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out.
Yeah, you go to 1965, 1% of the workforce every year was involved in the union election. And the unions were winning the overwhelming majority of those elections. And what I think happened is you had then, it's like three decades of labor that didn't have to fight hard. Not that there weren't still anti-union employers out there, but you could just ignore them because you had so many other places you could go. And so by the time you get the bad stuff, I think you've got a basic lack of experience where the people who built the CIO in the 30s, 40s, and 50s are long retired and dead. And people are going to rediscover it. So you get the Organizing Institute gets founded in the early 1990s. And it's got brilliant people who are doing amazing, brilliant organizing work. It's just all a little bit too little too late, because the other side just kept on pushing the ball forward. And so you get this, I don't know. I mean, I'm rambling now. But to me,
we this invited is, a PhD is, in labor history on. I mean,
it's, okay. I mean, seriously, it was your own damn fault. I really think that this is one of these things where you can blame everyone. You can also say everyone kind of tried as well as they could have given the circumstances, and it was just really effing tough. And if I went back in time to 1984, what could I have done differently? Like if I knew exactly what was going to happen for the next 40 years, what would I have done differently? NAFTA is one, I think, where you could definitely point to a place where I wish we could have found a different way around that. But there's not many others where you can really say we had an honest to God chance to change the course and we didn't.
Hillary or Jeff, do you guys want to, you know, the big question was kind of like, why did it get so bad for so long?
Jeff?
I'm going to take a large risk at somewhat disagreeing with a professor of labor history. I think we've completely neglected the Reagan factor here.
Well, Reagan said it started in the 80s, but go ahead.
Right, but Reagan's, when asked publicly why he wanted to be president, among the reasons he listed is that he wanted to destroy whatever was left of the New Deal. He also made it very, very easy and begun the Nixon begun the process, but really put the process in a higher gear of quite literally lifting entire sectors of our economy and shipping them overseas. The competition between states for hosting headquarters and large factories of companies didn't even come into the level that we see it now until the Reagan era. Reagan went to the convention of the Air Traffic Controllers Union and told them, give me your support and I will back you, and then crushed them and set a precedent for large corporations across this country to crush their own unions. We had the changing classifications of pensions so that they could be stolen. They weren't guaranteed anymore. And let's not forget also part of the Reagan strategy, the primary funders of the Democratic Party at that point were unions. If you destroyed the unions, you destroyed the major funding source for the Democratic Party and their candidates throughout the country. Dwight Eisenhower ran for re-election in 1956 saying, I expanded union membership and I protected unions, and Reagan crushed them. and he did it purposefully. I don't disagree with Dave in any way, shape, or form that unions, to a point, were, I hate this metaphor, the frog in the boiling water. I don't doubt that at all. And I would be terribly out of line to disagree with the professor. He knows more than me, flat out. But we can't forget that an entire political party who has represented only the rich and powerful and the big corporations for over a century said, we're going to go after that sector of American society and destroy it. And let's also remember Thatcher and Reagan both. We are not a community. We're not a society. We're all rugged individuals. No. What are unions? They're communities. They're democracy in the workplace.
And I just, the camera just panned back or you pulled back that we can see you wearing a Bethlehem Steel t-shirt. So
yeah,
props for that. Hillary, you know, do you want to add in any sort of the big, like, how did we get here?
Yeah, absolutely. Just taking in everything you guys said, but when it comes down to it, and I agree with both Dave and Jeff in their own ways. When we know better, we do better. And we didn't know better. And people were working and trying really hard, but the people, again, were not ready for it. And I think, and maybe time will prove me wrong, that this national pandemic, which is probably going to continue for at least another year now,
Or forever
changed how we live. I think that has really opened a lot of people's eyes to the inequalities that we face, the injustices that we face in the workplace, and the technology has caught up so that we can get together and organize. For instance, home care workers, we're stuck in our homes. 24/7. I'm not even joking. You know, we live at home because our communities are not friendly to people in wheelchairs or with disabilities. And so we already spend a lot of our time at home alone or with our family member, with our elders, our neighbors, whoever needed our care. And it was incredibly difficult, even just 2 years ago, for me to join in leadership and learning and educating myself on the movement and how I can be a part of it and the actions I can take. But now that we have the technology has caught up, it's made it a lot easier for us to get together and organize. And I think that's going to continue to grow. And I think that now is the time for great change. And that looking back on all the things, all the ways things have gone wrong in the before times, as we're calling it in my house, the before the pandemic, the before times, all the mistakes we made, we can learn from the last year and a half or whatever it's going to be, 2 years, 3 years. We can take what we've learned in this time and all the loss that all of us have gone through, and we can do better. So I hate pointing fingers and saying this person did that wrong and that person did that wrong. They definitely had a lot of big ideas that went sideways, right? And there's been a lot of pain and people have died because of it. But looking towards the future, I think we have the technology and certainly this Gen Z that is not here for it, any of it, any kind of negativity or nastiness in the workplace or not in our personal lives. And I'm really looking forward to what the future can hold for all of us.
That was great. That was very, very, very hopeful. You know, I think for sure, I think what Dave was describing and Jeff, I mean, I think, you know, both things can be true. Maybe that's me copping out as an academic, but, you know, the choices that particular unions made and like they're being lulled into what's called a false sense of security. I mean, there's other factors I feel like that are, in my mind, somewhat relevant. This kind of goes back to an earlier topic, but I do feel like there's just these cultural sort of factors matter. And there was just this sense that, you know, unions like, you know, like dirty coal and, you know, routinized industrialized work, you know, it was just sort of all kind of obsolete and sort of thing of the past. I mean, of course, that's ridiculous. Like one of my favorite sociologists, a guy named Castells, talks about the fourth world, right? So first, second, third, the fourth world is like in the big cities like New York, there's more illegal labor practices like in sweatshops in the last 20 years when he wrote this than there were like from the 40s to the 80s. But anyway, so the cultural factors is one. We didn't really get to, you know, I think some people, Dave, right, have maybe been critical of some unions about their ability to expand their base into people of color and women. So, it became about like not being aware of like trying to build that like multi-issue kind of rainbow coalition. All of those could be on the table.
In recent years, it's been immigration that's been the big one. You know, SEIU being the biggest outlier of the bunch that has always embraced immigrant workforces, but it's been "Dern foreigners stealing our jobs" has been too often a refrain that you heard in organized labor. And though we're in much better places than we were even 20 years ago, there's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to kind of wrap up, and I don't want to have the last word. So maybe we can start with Hillary, and we'll go Hillary, Jeff, Dave, but just kind of, you know, either something that you think is important or interesting and that you're looking towards. I don't want to force people into being, you know, hopeful if they're not feeling hopeful, but anything you want to lift up that's related to any of these themes?
Yeah, I think what just struck a chord with me was if Eisenhower had one, right? Eisenhower was certainly a very wonderful president, and he had a lot of forethought when it came to how to build our communities, right? And how to educate our youth and educate each other. And he developed this people-to-people student ambassador program, an ambassador program where it's a cultural exchange. When I was 12, was able to go to Australia as an ambassador through that program. And just as a child, being able to immerse yourself in someone else's culture changes the way that you see the world. And I think a lot of people have this tunnel vision where they believe everything that's in front of them and don't understand that literally the way we brush our teeth and everything else is made up. We just decided to do it that way.
What? And,
right? I know. What? Sorry. That everything that we do, from the glasses that we wear, the things that we drink, the way we drink them, it's all made up. And so we can choose to do it better. We can choose to do it a different way. And that's okay. And I think a lot of people in America just like don't get out of their little bubbles and have that cultural exchange. And if we were able to educate each other and get each other into more of a cultural exchange, I think that would go a long way into fixing, maybe not fixing, but mending the big divides that we are in the midst of right now. I've been saying it for several years that we're in the middle of a digital civil war, and we are, and people have become more entrenched. But the more that I speak with people and the more that I hear what they're going through, we know that there's a bell curve, right, of humanity, and that about 83% of us all feel basically the same way about everything. So when it comes down to it, what we're arguing is strategy. And what I've heard through the last hour and a half of us talking is that there's a lot of failed strategies, and that's okay because we have to try new things. But we have to continue trying new things then, and we have to recognize when things have gone wrong and gone sideways when they weren't meant to be that way. And we have to be careful about being too idealistic when we're organizing people or doing anything in our lives. Mm-hmm. I take individual responsibility, you know, for what's happening in my life and what I can affect change in. And what I can affect change in is I can call Congress and I can tell them and demand that they invest money into home and community-based services, because at least here in Pennsylvania, those home and community-based services are essentially non-existent at this point. There's not enough caregivers. We need anybody and everybody who is willing to work and be a caregiver to join our mm-hmm. workforce at this point. Mm-hmm. So when it comes down to it, you know, people have to want the lifestyle that they choose here in America. And a lot of people have chosen a lifestyle that removes them from their communities. And we really need to get back to that, the grassroots, the community, the getting to know each other, the trusting each other, the talking to each other, and sitting down and sharing a meal with each other.
Right, right. Excellent. Thank you. Jeff?
At the risk of being repetitive, Reagan and Margaret Thatcher told us, they didn't teach us, they told us we are not a society. We are not a community. That we are a group of rugged individuals. There's nothing further from the truth. If my house burns, yours is likely to go with it. And that binds us together. Unions are democracy in the workplace. They are your community in the workplace. Your coworkers are not just your coworkers at that point. They are your own union brothers and sisters. They are your workplace family. They are your community, your society. And we all know that when it comes to darn near anything, if 100 of us were at a concert and the artist says, shout me a request, and 51 of us shout for one thing, we win. That community came together, even as basic and as bad of an analogy as that might be.
And few people can go worse on analogies and metaphors than me.
Well, that was a pretty lousy one, let's be honest. But
over like a bowling ball in a pond.
But we and sank as quickly. But we, not to steal thunder from Dave, I should, you know, leave it to the professor, but so much of what we can learn, you know, Hillary mentioned failed strategies. How did the union movement build itself from the late 1800s into the 19-aughts, teens, and 20s? Successful strategies. Yes, it's a different economy today. There's no question. But that doesn't mean that so many of the lessons of what we are facing today as a country, the answers are in our own history. We need only look back and do a little bit of reading. It's hard as a political consultant to tell a campaign, to tell a candidate to stand behind that lectern and tell people we want to race back to the past. Candidates always look for the future. What can we do going forward? But sometimes the answers are in our own history. We simply have to have these educational moments again, like the one that we're having now, like the one I try to have every Sunday, and the ones that we have throughout the week when we meet and talk throughout the week, and even those casual conversations with neighbors when you walk out to the curb and help them bring in the garbage cans. Those casual conversations. And we just like Hillary mentioned, we don't fix everything. We're not going to fix 50 years of tearing this country apart overnight, but we can start to make the tiny stitch to put the American quilt back together.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's an A+ metaphor there. You know, I think it's interesting, and we should talk about this more some other time, Jeff, but I think maybe we also want to find ways to mutually embed community and individuals. Because I don't think it's a door out. Like, my capacity to be an individual is a way of functioning.
At the risk of another really bad metaphor, I love heavy metal, and my next door neighbor loves classical. I drown them out with my music, and they kindly knock on the door and say, could you turn it down? And I do turn it down. That's community. We love two different forms of music, but when I don't drown them out, that's community.
I was even picturing something more like, we all put money in for the football field where the quarterback throws the winning touchdown.
I defer. I yield.
But you know, that's Obama too. We all built it. So Dave, you know, I suspect you probably don't like being put on the pedestal as the professor, right?
Because I'm not a professor, right? I mean, I'm.
Yeah, you know, well, you do have those three letters, you know.
Yes. No, I mean, this has been a really fun conversation, and I you know, I think the way Heather put it is right. Like, this is. At the end of the day, talk to people, connect with people, and connect to more people. And the more we do that, the better we're going to be, regardless of what we talk and connect about or with. And you, the rest of it, you know, takes time, and you got to go through it. But talk to people, connect, ask questions, listen, you know, say your own things, connect, and that'll be our way forward. It's not going to be easy, but it never is. And it, you know, that's just the nature of the beast.
At the risk of breaking the rules that I set up and trying to let you have the last word, but I just can't help point this out. But Dave, to build on that, and it actually released to The Forge, Hari Hahn's book, Prisms of People, I think, that she wrote with someone else. I've only read a couple of pages, but she's a scholar who studies social movements and this. But one of the things she says is that organizations and movements, that they have to make active strategy decisions that are about the constituencies of people and how they engage them. And so I think, just to kind of reinforce strategy and organization in this, I think all of you all would agree. It's like, not just, I mean, it does matter to go out and talk to your neighbor, but also, like, we need organizations that build strategies so that all of us can go out and talk to people and build those conversations. Is that a note we can end on? Thank you so much. You know, this podcast and this effort is, like I said, it's a passion project, and it's only as good as the wonderful people come in and share their insights. And, you know, we have some friendly disagreements. I'm going to end the stream now. So thanks, everybody. You know, tune in, like us, subscribe us, all of that.